Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're digging into race relations in Rapid City today with an in-depth conversation with Karen Mortimer, Heather Dawn Thompson, and Kibby Conte. They represent the Rapid City Circle of Friends, Mini Luzaha, Okolo Kichiapi Ambassadors. And we've got Karen and Kibby there in our Rapid City studios right now. Karen Mortimer, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. We appreciate being here.
And Kibby Conte, welcome as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to have Heather Dawn Thompson on the phone here in just a minute, but we're going to start with Karen and Kibby for now as we get the phone situation worked up. And the context for our listeners is here on Thursday, May 4th. That's this week at 6:30 Mountain Time at the Journey Museum. You can learn about the history behind Sioux Sand Lands and West Rapid City. And this is a conversation about land, about the law, about legislation, race, how natives and non-natives in South Dakota understand one another today, how that might change in the future. Karen, let's start with you and tell me, for those of us who haven't, might not remember the Rapid City Circle of Friends, what the ambassadors do.
Well, the ambassadors, sort of something that we always say is that history and place matter and relationships matter. And so our journey is to bridge cultures and to educate ourselves and others, advocate and model respectful behaviors. And it's a group of Native and non-Native leaders who have come together to do this work in our city.
All right. And Karen, as you're in that studio there, China Lockett with SDPB is with you. I'm going to ask China to do some adjustments to your microphone so we can hear Karen Mortimer a little bit better. Kibby, I'm hearing you pretty well, and I'm wondering what your background is and your involvement with the ambassadors in this project.
Well, the ambassadors has been an amazing team that helped to bring the synergy for this to come to where it is today, where we can share it publicly. My background is I've worked for Indian Health for many years, 20 years, as a dietitian. But my family's been part of this community. I mean, my grandmother went to the Rapid City Indian School. She sent her children to that school. And, you know, the TB sanatoriums where my family members worked. And so I'm very much intimately connected to the place.
Mm. So part of this project, it's maybe a five-fold project. There's various steps to it, Karen, and it begins with publishing an accurate historical record for the community through the Rapid City Journal. Can you tell us a little bit about, does the record of the Rapid City Indian Boarding School lands, of Sioux Sand, of what happened to these lands and the city of Rapid City, did that record not exist anywhere else?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. I think Kibby and Heather are researchers. But we don't think to date that this information has been shared in this way. There was a book written by a gentleman by the name of Scott Riney, who did his doctoral dissertation on the Rapid City Indian Boarding Schools. There's a book, Madonna Swan's A Lakota Woman's Story, talks about this. I know Tim Gallego has written some work about Indian boarding schools in general. Mm-hmm. But the work that we will be publishing in the journal on Wednesday is newly authored work by four authors. The authors are Kibby Conte, Heather Dawn Thompson, Karen Eagle, and Scott Riney. So this information is new, and as we say at the beginning of the insert that will be in the journal, that this is the beginning of our work to unfold this history. It's actually historic. This is historic, we think. So
right. We're going to bring Heather Dawn Thompson into the conversation with us. I believe she's on the phone now. Heather, are you with us?
I am.
Excellent. Welcome, and thank you for being here. We're talking about a little bit of background. We haven't gotten into the history itself yet, but before we do that, I wonder if you can tell me why, give me the big picture why, Heather, of why people need to know this story, need to know the real details of it, the complexity of it. What is it going to help them put into perspective?
Sure. we think one of the benefits of this conversation is that it really is a microcosm of some of the larger trends and historical issues within South Dakota, the Black Hills, and Rapid City. A lot of times when we discuss historical issues, it's difficult for people to wrap their head around because it feels so very long ago and they feel often disconnected from that conversation. But this is a microcosm that affected all of us that continue to live together as a community in Rapid City. This is a very real and very modern history. And our hope and prayer is that by sharing this conversation together, by sharing our research and the stories of the people who came before us, that it will help us move towards a more positive relationship within the Rapid City community and the Black Hills community as a whole.
Kibbe, this history goes back a long ways, of course, but then it also, you know, we're talking 1948 and such, so it's not the distant past. Let's start, though, back in 1890 and talk about the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. Give me some background there.
Okay. Back in the time when the school was built, the government's policy was acculturation, and part of that was to have the children totally enmeshed into white society, including the education. So they opened this off-reservation boarding school along with many, many others across the nation. And so it drew from three states, kids from Wyoming, South Dakota, North Dakota. And those kids would arrive, and they'd work half a day at the school because it was really a farm. It had a dairy barn, a horse barn, fields of crops. And so the kids worked half a day, and they went to school half a day. And the entire time the school was open, it was like that until 1933. So the land was acquired, that large land base, to be self-sustaining. And this is prior to it when it was never actually part of the city at that point. It was just out in the country. And then, ultimately it was not a success. And they were closed. All of these off-reservation boarding schools were closed in the 30s during the Depression. So
1,200 acres in what is now considered West Rapid City. And Heather, tell me what living conditions are like there and for the children. And then how are the families sort of interacting with their children in the boarding school? How far out do the ripples of impact go?
Sure. So unfortunately, most of the children were taken from their families without consent. There are, as time evolved, sometimes that did change, particularly in the early years. It was sort of a forced assimilation process. So as you can imagine, most of the children were quite scared and not particularly looking forward to attending the boarding school so far away from their families. In addition, the children were only allowed to see their family once a year in the summertime, and even then they were only allowed to go home to see their family if their family was able to afford a round-trip ticket to show that they would, in fact, return in the fall. So in general, the boarding school history is not a particularly positive one for most of the Native American community. You had, in general, entire generations of Native American children that were raised without parents and therefore didn't have those parenting skills that were passed down. In addition, while I don't think this is necessarily as true with the Rapid City Indian Boarding School per se, many of the other boarding schools, unfortunately, in order to recruit teachers to such isolated rural areas, had a large degree of individuals with pedophilia, and that was perpetrated on the students and then unfortunately passed down as well. In addition, at the Rapid City Indian Boarding School specifically, we do know that a number of children died both from diseases that they didn't have strong immunity from, as well as an attempt to try to escape from the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. So the documents and the records are quite poor from that time period, but we have identified approximately 40 to 50 children that we believe passed away while at the school.
Heather, where are you, finding archives? Where are you digging up the? As I look through the information that you provided, or that Karen provided me, of just some background, the research is dense. There's all kinds of information you were able to access. It's a big project. Tell me a little bit about some of the research work that has gone into preparing this record.
Sure. Of course, as Karen mentioned, Scott Riney came before us in his research, and he actually wrote his PhD dissertation on this. And he obtained a lot of his records both from the South Dakota historical archives, which contain rolls and rolls of microfiche of the actual official records by the boarding school that were not destroyed. In addition, he went through, as well as our team, went through a number of Rapid City Journal microfiches from that time period. So we have a lot of current news articles, both reflecting the deaths as well as reflecting some of the policy conversations at the time. And then we have also gone through as many deeds, legal documents, and any governmental documents that we were able to find. So it's been a compilation of that, as well as many of the family of the many of the descendants of the families that were at the boarding school, that were at the entity when it became the Susan Tuberculosis Clinic, that have been fighting for years to advocate regarding this land, have very carefully kept their own personal family records, and we've been very blessed to obtain the trust of many of those families to share those records with us.
Kibbe, what's the, you know, impact of descendants still living in this area right now? How many people have been touched by the generational impact of the Rapid City Indian Boarding School?
Well, a lot of the families that first came to Rapid City, including my own, came here partly because the school was here. And so that would give them closer proximity to their children, and their merging Native community kind of sprung from the school. And initially, where the Sioux Park is, that's where our people would come and camp when their kids were at school, or even the TB era. That was always the area where we would camp. So, but the legacy of the school is it helped our community emerge here and grow here, and we're still here. So I think the elders also, I want to remember, this story would not be here, really, were it not for them. They were constantly the ones reminding us of this history. Whenever you come to town and you're learning about Rapid, you'll have conversations with them. And they were very concerned. Sadly, we've lost a lot of these elders, so there's fewer and fewer of them left to share these stories. So that's why this history forum is so vital, that we pass this information to the next generation.
Kibbe, when does the Indian Boarding School transform into the sanatorium or Susan?
Okay. Like I said, during the Depression, it closed in 33, but it was occupied by the Civil Conservation Corps for several years. But it reopened in 1938 as the current TB, the hospital that we operate at today, was opened at 1938. So that epidemic was really very... widespread. About 10% of the Native men were identified as having TB when the Army was testing them for to be enlisted. So, yeah, it did operate as a sanatorium until that epidemic was under control in the 60s.
Hmm. Another wave of migration, Heather, at this point then, or... are people still staying in the same spot, or are more people coming? Let's talk a little bit about Rabbit Creek and sort of the migration of more and more Natives to that area. Heather?
Absolutely. So there, you know, to make sure that we're clear, to put in historical context, Rapid Creek has always been a home to the Lakota and to many other tribes in the region as well. It is sort of the gateway to the Black Hills. And so there are lots of really important historical stories about the births and deaths of very famous people within our community from the 1600s, 1700s, etc., and life along the creek. So that's important to put that first in context. That's always been a hub for traditional Native American life. Okay. But then, of course, in the 1800s, there was a policy by the federal government to remove the Native American tribes from the Black Hills because gold had been discovered there. So the tribes, as you know, there's a difficult, bloody history, were forcibly removed from the Black Hills and contained onto the smaller Native American reservations throughout the Great Plains. So that was, mid to late 1800s. In the modern time period, a migration began back to the Rapid City, and that's sort of what we're really talking about now. How did people return? And as Kibbe said, one of the very first waves of migration in the modern era from the Native community was with the boarding school. When the children were taken from their homes, a lot of family members chose to move themselves to Rapid City in order to be closer to their children. And most of them not having a lot of financial resources and family ties in the area, camped along the river, which was a historical camping location for them. The second major wave of migration came when it became a tuberculosis clinic, and an even larger population base was quarantined at Suzanne's tuberculosis clinic, and it was a segregated tuberculosis clinic. It was only Native Americans. The non-Native tuberculosis clinic was located in Custer. So a lot of family members, again, moved to be closer to their family that were quarantined sometimes, you know, for a decade at the Susan for TB. And then a third wave, modern wave of migration came during World War II. Some people came to work in the war industries, but a very significant percentage of people from the Oglala Sioux Reservation, including Kitty's family, she can speak to this more personally, were forced to leave when the federal government turned a section of the Oglala Sioux Reservation into a bombing range during World War II. And so they were evacuated, given 30 days to evacuate. And with such short a time period, many of them simply went to Rapid City, where their other family members were living along the river.
Kibby, you want to add to that from a personal perspective of family stories passed down?
Well, just, you know, in the Badlands, there's the government claimed that land to train pilots. They needed, it was a war where there was airplanes and bombing. It was turned into aerial bombing range. So 125 families were displaced and given 2 weeks' notice to leave, to get out. And there was no relocation. They had to figure out where they were going to go. And so some of those families did come to Rapid City. But the emerging community sprung up along the Rapid Creek. And I know my family lived in an army tent, you know, my grandparents, until they could live in a little shanty and then ultimately had a house. So they, you know, they really, thank goodness, they had a strong work ethic and they were both able to find work. So, but it was a hard road, and especially since housing was always a challenge and we desperately needed housing. And that leads to the issue where ultimately when the lands were available, why our community never was granted housing on the Susan lands. So
if you're just tuning in, you're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting Radio. I'm Lori Walsh. This is In the Moment. My guests in Rapid City, Karen Mortimer, Kibby Conti, on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. We have Heather Dawn Thompson. The way you can interact with this, there's a number of ways, but first, May 4th, 2017, just this Thursday, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Mountain Time at the Journey Museum, the Minilusaha Okala Kichiapi ambassadors are going to have a presentation called An Inconvenient Truth, the History Behind Susan Lands and West Rapid City. We need to take a quick break and we'll come back and have more with these guests. Before we take that break, Karen Mortimer, anything you want to close out this segment with before we jump into the next segment and really talk about what happens in 1948 and what's happening now?
Well, we really feel like this is important to take this very well-researched history and put it in the hands of our whole community. We definitely do this to acknowledge that history is important and relative to finding understanding.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. We'll be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking today about An Inconvenient Truth, the History Behind Susan Lands and West Rapid City. This is a presentation and a project you can be a part of on May 4th at 6:30 to 8 Mountain Time at the Journey Museum. And my guests today are from the Rapid City Circle of Friends or the Minilusaha Okolo Kichiapi ambassadors. We've got Karen Mortimer and Kibby Conte in our studio at Rapid City, and then Heather Dawn Thompson is with us on the phone from Washington, D.C. And Karen, at this event Thursday at 6:30 Mountain Time, give me an idea of what is going to be presented and who the audience is going to, you know, who would you like to come?
Well, the presentation, I want to say from the beginning, is being sponsored by the Minilusaha Okolo Kichiapi ambassadors and the mayor of Rapid City, Mayor Steve Allender. So together we are sponsoring this and bringing this to the community. Heather Dawn Thompson and Kibby Conti will be the presenters. And we hope that the community We hope the community comes. We hope that people who might not even normally come to something like this, but who've lived in Rapid City for a long time or a short time, will come and with a spirit of learning and a respectful curiosity. And we are really all proud to call Rapid City and the Black Hills our home. We grew up here. Some of us grew up here. Some of us chose to move here. Some of us live here today. But doing something, anything to make our community better really gives us energy. So we welcome all from the community.
Kibby, tell me how to approach a really complex historical conversation like this, you know, within the context of 2017 in Rapid City. What do you think is important to bring to the table?
I guess it all leads to today. So we're connected to our past. Where our community is today is a reflection of the things that occurred that we're going to discuss. In a sense, you know, how is it that Rapid City has the largest urban Indian population, highest impoverished rate, which is 50%, and that's documented? It's definitely connected to this past that, and in our history, there were people who were given the haves and people that were really not given some of the benefits of, like I said, the land or housing. It's like, you know, our community really was disadvantaged, and it was kind of by design. I hate to say that, but I hope that we can learn from the past and correct our way so that all people have equal opportunities.
Heather, let's jump ahead to 1948 and how the city of Rapid City, because this land is not part of the city right now. It's 1,200 acres in what's now known as West Rapid, owned by Susan, and the city is pushing westward. Give me an idea of what happens next, Heather.
Sure. There was approximately 1,200 acres going from what is now Mountain View Road to Canyon Lake. And this was after World War II, of course, and the city of Rapid was trying to press westward. So in 1947, they actually annexed a significant portion of West Rapid, but of course didn't have the land base to start moving the population base significantly westward. So a coalition between the National Guard, the Rapid City Chamber of Commerce, the Catholic Church, and the City of Rapid lobbied Congress for a special law that allowed them to have access to these 1,200 acres. There are three provisions within that law, three different types of entities that were allowed to be gifted or purchase the land. The first section was for the city, the school district, or the National Guard. And those three entities could receive the land for free for municipal, educational, or National Guard purposes, with the caveat that because it was being received, granted for free, it has a reversion clause. So when that land is no longer being utilized for municipal, educational, and National Guard purposes, it reverts back to the Department of Interior Bureau of Indian Affairs. Hmm. The second provision allowed churches to purchase the land for reasonable value. And in the end, approximately 9 churches purchased plots in that arena. Some of them kept their plots, and some of them flipped their plots, probably for profit, to build housing. And then the third and final area that was allowed to receive some of these lands, the nomenclature at the time was quote-unquote needy Indians. So any of those lands could be used for needy Indians or exchanged for other land for needy Indians. And that was what was outlined.
In quotations, needy Indians. What does that mean in the historical context?
In historical context, it was a common verbiage at the time. This is when a lot of the social programs were being put in place at the federal level after the Great Depression. And so particularly with farming and social access programs, that was a common verbiage at the time.
So how does that play out? What happens then to, you know, address that need, if you will?
So unfortunately, and one of the more difficult aspects of the story that we're retelling is, despite decades of requests under that third category, needy Indians, none of the acreage was allocated for needy Indians or traded for Indians.
What kind of requests were made?
So the most significant request was when the land initially began being gifted out, the community that was living predominantly along the river, the native community, made a formal request to have Indian housing on the land and near what was the Rapid City Indian Boarding School and Sioux Sand site, because of obvious historical relationship with that site. And unfortunately, there was significant pushback from the residents of Rapid City that were already living in Western Rapid City, and threatened to essentially file lawsuits against the city council if they allowed that to happen. Hmm. And so that conversation has significantly affected the demographics of the city today and how it looks and where people live and are located, because what happened was they did sort of an odd land swap where what is now a middle school called West Middle School, that land was given to the city. The city sold it to the school district for $15,000, and then that money was utilized to purchase land very, very far outside of the city limits at that time, very far north, about 2 miles from the river. And then the native community was asked to relocate far north of the community. And that was a difficult move, as there was no sewer or water. So those families had to haul water from the river for over a decade until water and sewer was installed. But you can see this living patterns in modern Rapid City as well. The majority of the native population continues to live significantly north of the city in North Rapid, where this community, Sioux Addition, was placed in the 1950s.
Kibbe Conti, I want to ask you, how does knowing and understanding this history and really looking at the complexities of it have the potential to make a meaningful change in the present?
Wow, that's a challenging question. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I just think the history is so vital that we all understand. And I think this is the first time that we've really established an accurate timeline, and we have the evidence to support that timeline. So, you know, thanks to Heather, who did a lot of hours of research, and she's had other helpers assisting her. And I kind of began with the research when I was chairing the history committee. We did a 75th anniversary at Sioux Sand in 2013. And so now that we actually have this accurate timeline and we're willing to share this in a public forum and also publish it in the Rapid City Journal tomorrow in an insert, you know, it's up to the people. It's up to the residents to determine how this is going to shape the way we operate in the future. I think we live in a different time now. It's totally a different era, and the way I think we embrace all people today is really gives me hope that hopefully we can, you know, find ways that everybody's going to have a better opportunities for the things we all take for granted, housing and education and all of those services. And, you know, but it's really always been the women, which is ironic. The women have always been the leaders in this community, advocating and establishing services for our Native community. And so I think it's a continuation of what they had begun, the women back in the 50s and the 60s.
Karen Mortimer, I want to ask you kind of the same question, see if you have any thoughts on that. How does really understanding the timeline, having it documented, what's the potential impact of that on the present day and the future? How could it play out?
Well, I would kind of echo what Kibbe had to say. This is our first attempt. We're beginning. This is a beginning effort to try to share a really important history. So we're not sure We're not sure. We're careful. We've been very, very carefully unfolding this story. And we do this with a great deal of respect for our whole community. We want to bring this, as I said before, I think that this history is important and relevant to finding understanding. And so as we celebrate who we are as a culturally rich community, we also look at this difficult history and bring this to the community as a whole in a tone of peace so we can work through conflicts that we identify. We have broken relationships or perhaps lack of relationships in our community. And so with greater understanding and with by respectfully being curious and seeking understanding and celebrating, I think we can identify what makes us different as people and common. And we really do celebrate this because we're different probably than anywhere else in the nation. And we have a wonderful opportunity to learn together and to grow together and become stronger together. So I hope that answers. That's the best I can do on this answering that question today, Lori.
Heather, as you dug deeply into this research, tell me what surprised you or what you think, Rapid City residents, members of the community will be surprised by. What do they not already know?
I think what surprised me the most was the absolute lack of any communication between the Native and the non-Native community. These decisions predominantly were made clearly without any input from the Native community, at least early on. So that was one thing that was particularly surprising. The second thing that was very surprising for me was the institutional flexibility that was given to the non-Native community that was not given to the Native community.
What do you mean by that?
There was a high degree of comfort in bending the rules for the non-Native community and an over-strictness in application of the rules to the Native community.
All right, so this is a presentation called An Inconvenient Truth, The History Behind Sioux San Lands and West Rapid City. It's May 4th. That's this week, Thursday, 6:30 to 8 Mountain Time at the Journey Museum. You can see, we're just scratching the surface today on In the Moment. There's maps, there's articles. Rapid City Journal tomorrow will have a special insert so you can dig more into this. Karen Mortimer, let's close with you and sort of how else can people be part of the conversation? Is there a way to make comments and engage with this? And what happens next with this project after this public presentation?
Well, likely we will hold more public presentations. This isn't the end. I think both the mayor and I feel like we are just beginning. Heather and Kibbe, Karen Eagle and Scott Riney have done an incredible job of bringing the history forward in word. And so I look to more forums. We are hoping to get a documentary put together at some point in the future. We're not sure when and where, how, but we hope that will be able to. That's a dream that we have, and we want that to live within Rapid City, in the city office. We are hoping to develop an academic paper that will help, with all the documentation that's appropriate. And for now, our website, the Minnesota Nokolokee Chapi Ambassadors website, MOA, you can find that at moarapidcity.org. And we want to continue the conversation, and we're excited about being able to share this first presentation. So thank you so much for inviting us on the show today, and we hope to have more conversations with you as we move forward.
We hope so, too. If you're just tuning in the moment, SDPB Radio, my guests for this hour have been Karen Mortimer, Heather Dawn Thompson, and Kibbe Conti. Karen and Kibbe are there in the Rapid City studios for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Heather joined us from Washington, D.C. Karen, thank you so much for being here. We'll see you again.
Thank you.
Heather, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Kibbe, thanks for your insight. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.